Welcome, everyone, to the Apocalypse Podcast. I'm Steve.
As I'm Larry. Know.
Oh, he jumped in already. Look at that, folks. He's fast on the mark. This is going to be an absolutely amazing podcast, everyone. He's here. It's Dr. Lawrence Van Beek, everybody. I'm Steve Morris, not the important one, but he is, right? So today, we're talking about the seven seals.
We are, Steve. And before we talk about the seven seals, I know that in the last lesson, we were talking about the rapture. I mentioned when people are talking of the millennium, they talk about the lion laying down with the lamb. And Lynn asked me, she said, so where is that in scripture? And I recalled that it's not in scripture, that it's after I looked it up again, it's out of Isaiah 11. There's the lion and the calf, and there's the wolf lion lying with the lamb. But you know, after he puts on sheepskin clothing, I'm sure. So the actual expression isn't scriptural. It's one of those things that people pick up and they adjust a little bit to suit themselves, and we run with it from there.
Yeah.
Very much like them eat cake and things.
Yeah.
Like
yeah. Yeah. And it sounds nice too, right? So.
And I have a statue of a lion with a lamb at my house, and I'm not going to throw it away just because of this.
Yeah. Okay. No, fair enough. Fair enough. It's not heresy. It's just a nice vision of Christ and the reconciliation of the kingdom.
Yeah.
So it's all good. Yeah. No, thanks for doing that there. Okay. Well, yeah, folks. And as you can see, we're excited to talk about the seals. And we're excited to do this podcast. Could you tell by just the way we jumped at it right away?
Yeah. And we're not going to do seal noises or. We won't do that. talk about Christmas seals.
Christmas and Easter seals are the first things that came to mind, and already we've invoked the wrath of wow. You know, if you don't think we have fun doing this, folks, you're absolutely wrong. We actually have more fun doing this than we'd like to admit. So once again, I'm going to read out of the ESV and letting Dr. Van Beek be our guide. I'm going to read from verses 1 through 8, and then we'll kind of come back to 9 and the rest of the book after that. But and then we'll kind of double back on the various seals that we see open in that first section. So without further ado, let's jump right in, shall we? Starting at verse 1. Now I watched when the Lamb opened one of the seven seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures say with a loud voice like thunder, "Come." And I looked, and behold, a white horse, and its rider had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he came out conquering and to conquer. And when he opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, "Come." And out came another horse, bright red. Its rider was permitted to take peace from the earth, so that people should slay one another. And he was given a great sword. When he opened the third seal, I heard the living creature say, "Come." And I looked, and behold, a black horse, and its rider had a pair of scales in its hand. And I heard what seemed to be a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, "A quart of wheat for a denarius, and 3 quarts of barley for a denarius. Do not harm the oil and wine." And I opened the fourth seal, and I heard a voice of the fourth living creature say, "Come." And I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and its rider's name was Death, and Hades followed him. And they were given authority over a fourth of the earth to kill with the sword and with famine, with pestilence, and by the wild beasts of the earth.
So, Steve, you notice that there are four here.
Yeah.
Here you have the four horses. So what you've got is the four seals, then you'll get the two seals, and then you'll get the final. With the trumpets and bowls, it'll be the same thing. There'll be four, two escalating, and then a final one. And so this is the pattern for the seals, the trumpets, and the bowls. So he starts off with, I watched and the Lamb opened one of the seals. So remember, the one who can open the seals is the Lamb. The Lamb was the only one. In chapter 5, he wept and wept and no one could open the seals. And one of the elders said to him, the Lamb can open the seals. So here's the Lamb opening one of the seals. And now one of the four living creatures with a voice like thunder, like thunder for God, with that kind of a voice says, "Come." And I actually always thought he was saying to John, "Come." But one of the commentators pointed out, and it sounds actually better when he says come, he's talking to the horse and the rider.
Okay.
Okay. So he's saying, come to the horse. And the very first one he looks, he sees a white horse. The rider has a bowl, he's given a crown, and he's coming out to conquer, out conquering and to conquer. Now, the colors don't work perfectly for us. They actually don't work very well at all, because this horse is white. The rest do. The red horse is blood. The black horse is famine. The pasty yellow horse, the pale horse, is not Clint Eastwood, I don't think.
Yeah.
Who can ride in a pale horse if I'm not somewhere along the way. But this one is death. It's the final one is death. Now, some of the commentators look at this first horse and they say the rider coming on the white horse is Christ, because Christ comes on a white horse in chapter 19.
Okay.
Right? Or he comes on a horse wearing white. And they say, so this is Christ, and this is all talking about salvation, but very few commentators would agree with that.
Okay.
And then others, if they saw the rapture just before this, right, if you're a pre-trib rapturist and you saw the rapture before this, they look at this and they say this rider on a white horse is the Antichrist.
Hmm.
So he's coming in, and now we've got the beginning of the 7 years, right? So the Antichrist is coming in, he's bringing the others. Most commentators won't go that way with it at all. They'll say, what's happening here is the rider on the white horse is what we call incipient warfare. So these four horses are going to be the natural outcome of humanity in warfare.
Oh, okay, okay.
So the first rider is the beginning of warfare. And that he's given a crown throws us off, because that could point to the Antichrist or to Christ, but it's nation rising against nation. The first rider's coming in and he's beginning the war. Now, some will say, and I like this one, that this is an image of the Parthians. And the Parthians were a group of people that lived in the hills near one of the Roman settlements, and they actually had a major victory against Rome in AD 62. So if he was writing just after AD 62, or if he's writing, you know, in AD 85, 25 years later, he could be recalling this battle with the Parthians. And the Parthians were known. They actually have an expression in Britain called the Parthian shot. And it's a dead shot, right?
Okay.
Like Deadeye, the bullseye guy. And the Parthians were known for riding by on their horses, which we often saw in our movies with the indigenous people riding by and shooting off horses. Well, these guys were known for that too. They could turn in their horse and they could hit a target dead on as they were riding by. Hmm. And so some would like to say that is the image that John's thinking of. Some say, no, it can't be the Parthians. It's got to be something else. What most of us agree on is that this is the beginning of warfare.
Okay. Okay. So kind of, like, I mean, when you say that, is it kind of like the war, like just a continuous period of 7 years of all-out warfare, or a symbolic warfare?
Well, if you see this book literally, then this warfare is real.
Okay.
Right? And when you get down to verse number 8, as you read, a fourth of the earth is killed with this.
Mm-hmm.
So you think that when people were entering the First World War, there were people thinking, this is the tribulation. I mean, this is a world war. Everybody's getting involved. When the Second World came on, and you know, you had the war in Europe, and then the war in the Pacific, very much pulling in the whole world into that war, a fourth of the world being a part of it. They very much thought that they were in the end times.
Right? Mm, okay.
But most of us will say this is the beginning of warfare. Every time warfare happens, there's this beginning of warfare, and then you get to the second horse.
Okay.
So when he opens the second seal, I heard a second living creature say, come. And then he sees another horse. Now this one fits, right? Where we can't really figure out what to do with the white of the white horse, unless you believe it's the Antichrist, it works really well. But if you don't see that, then you don't know what to do with the white horse, because every other place where there's white, it seems to talk about righteousness and the righteousness of the saints and the clothing that the Laodiceans could put on, which was righteousness,
right.
The clothing that Jesus wears. But the second horse works really well. He's blood red. And he is taking peace from the earth. So you have the beginning of warfare. Now the second seal is all-out warfare. Wherever you're involved in warfare, you have the beginning and then you have the all-out war, the total melee that happens in war. And there's blood shed everywhere. This guy's given a great sword, and he can ride through and create warfare. And people do this everywhere, right? You hear stories in every war. You hear horrific stories of the things that people are able to do to each other in war. You know, killing each other, slaughtering each other, torturing each other. You often hear of women where they kill their babies. They kill pregnant mothers and their babies in horrific ways. And there's blood everywhere. And in chapter 14, he'll talk about blood to the horses' bridles for 160 stadia. And so the second horse is open warfare.
Okay.
So if you've, I'll let you jump in anytime you want, Steve. But
oh, no worries. You're doing great. And I really don't know what else to say other than, wow, okay.
then the third one is actually, the third living creature says, come, the black horse comes out, and he's carrying a pair of scales, which at first doesn't sound anything like warfare, right? Mm. You know, we think of scales for justice, you know, the blind with the blind scales. But in this time, there's a voice in the midst of the four living creatures is crying out, a quart of wheat for a denarius and three quarts of barley for a denarius. In your other one, it'll say a quart of wheat for a day's wages, if you read it in the NIV, or three quarts of barley. And whenever there's warfare, the end of warfare is famine. And we know that very strongly when the Germans were and I'm going to the Second World War because it's easy. When the Germans were fighting the Russians and they were pushing in towards Stalingrad, the story goes that the Russians destroyed all of their crops on the way, and their biggest thing was they cut off the German line for their supplies, and the German soldiers were actually starving as they were moving in. And after the war ended, there was quite a famine in Germany as well. And in other places in the world, this has happened. War, because people are involved in warfare, they're not involved in agriculture, they're not involved in any kind of industry. So the food supplies dwindle and you're starving to death afterwards. So that's what's happening in this one. And we usually say famine and plague as well, because those are the things that come when if you see the refugees coming out of any of the countries now, you know, you can't get good water and you get sick and you don't have medicines. And so they're crying out from the midst of this, a quart of wheat for a denarius. And was it Herodotus who said a quart of wheat is a daily ration for a soldier. And a denarius was a day's wages. So it's a daily ration of wheat for a day's wages. Or if you're a poorer person, because barley was cheaper, you could buy three quarts of barley and you could use it. It's not as nutritious, I think, or not as tasty. I don't know which, but it's, you could feed your family. So if you're poor, the creatures are crying out like, allow us enough just to feed our family.
Okay. Oh, that makes so much more sense now when you read this, because it's kind of an odd sort of thing without context, right?
Yeah.
And
what is that if you can't have wheat? I said lactose intolerant, you can't have milk.
you're gluten-free.
Yeah, you have to have gluten-free. You have that gluten issue. Then you can't have wheat, so this doesn't work for you at all.
Yeah.
So, and then the last little bit there, do not harm the oil and the wine. And they say in the later days of the first century of Rome, the emperor, crazy, I forgot his name now. As you should remember his name, Steve. Who was the emperor when John wrote this thing? that's a bad slip. It'll come back.
It's not Nero, right? Because it's too
Nero,
late.
Nero was in 50.
Yeah. So I'm trying to think who's...
And they said he was trying to increase the wheat product. And so he tried to cut off the growing of the olives and the grapes.
Mm.
And people just, they fought back so hard, he couldn't do it. He actually backed off because his own people said no. Not because others, because he just killed them, but his own people said no, and he backed off. And the whole idea of do not harm the oil and the wine, from my teachers, they said, this would be, if you're poor, you can barely make it. But in the very beginning, if you have the money, you can still afford to live your life. So the effect of war affects poorer people first, and the wealthier people can make it in the early days, right?
Right.
And they can still afford the oil and the wine, which is something for richer people. So that's the idea behind. Others say, no, oil and wine, olives and grapes, their roots grow deeper than, and they can handle, and they can still produce. But I think it has more to do with a class thing that's going on here.
Right. Okay.
And it's just the basic results of warfare.
Right.
People die. People get sick, and then they start to starve. And then you have your fourth seal, and the fourth living creature. He says, "Come," and I don't think it was important, even though some might say it is, to say which particular creature it was every time.
Right.
The fourth one was the eagle, wasn't it? And he says, and I looked and behold a pale horse, and its rider's name was Death, and Hades followed him. And they're given authority over the fourth of the earth to kill with the sword and famine and pestilence, here it is, and wild beasts of the earth. And so at the end of war and during war and during this whole period, there's just death that comes, right?
Right. Right.
And it mentions it all again, the famine, the pestilence, and the wild beasts. Now, we don't ever think of wild beasts killing us, but in those days, if you're wandering around in the woods, you know, there were animals that could kill you.
Right.
And nowadays, too, right? If you're out, if you're out jogging by yourself, you know, you could get killed. And they talk about coyotes killing people. And even deer and elk and other animals killing, or
where you and I used to, you know, live in this part of the world, they would have cougars that would pull people off the track, or mountain lions even. So
no, that's right. Yeah. Beautiful cats though, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. just not when you want to hear purring.
When you're in a car, it's not so bad.
Yeah. Yeah. But stop eating me.
Other people talk a lot about this rider too. And the rider's name is Death.
Mm.
And following on the heels of death is Hades. And some people are quite, they want to spend time and talk about, well, Hades isn't riding a horse. Death gets to ride a horse. Hades has to kind of trundle along behind.
Yeah.
Like the squire behind the knight running beside him. But the whole idea here, of course, is after you die, you know, the place of departed souls is Hades. And there's not a distinction here, and we don't really want to spend a lot of time talking about the distinction between Gehenna and Sheol and Hades and Hell and all of these different things. Some will make Hades the same as Hell. Others say, no, Hades is the place for departed spirits, and then Hell is the final destination, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the whole idea, of course, is that you die, and now you're awaiting this final destination.
Okay.
So those are the four horsemen of the apocalypse. I remember when we worked at Trinity and we worked with Dave. If you remember, Dave's wife worked with horses, and I thought we could write a book, you know, caring for the four horses. what do these four horses actually need?
I good luck. Yeah, I'm not sure I'd want to be the one looking after them.
No. They might be Harry Potter type creatures, but
yes.
So anyway, so that's the whole idea here, and most of us at least agree that is what it's talking. It's talking about humanity in warfare, and these are the things that happen in warfare. So if you want to make it the end times, and this is the Antichrist on the first one, you can do that. I still can't do the symbolic. That this is somehow pointing to salvation. I can't wrap my head around that very much. That it was warfare in John's time, very much so. That it's warfare all through the centuries, very much so as well.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. Yeah, thanks again, because especially on that third seal is where we'd read this and kind of not get the context of it without going, what? It just doesn't make any sense. But that that actually illuminates that whole group of four horsemen there when you see that one thing that, yes, there's warfare, but there's also these collateral, you know, because there's warfare, people die of famine and of sickness. And like you said, just in World War, you know, the end of the First World War, influenza ran through because, you know, you got death and it's just one thing after another after another. So, okay. Should I read through? Do you want me to read the next two seals here, bud?
Or maybe just do the fifth.
Okay, let's do the fifth then. So folks, we'll be reading from verses 9 through to 11, okay? When he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the witness they had borne. They cried out with a loud voice, O sovereign Lord, holy and true, how long before you will judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? And then they were each given a white robe and told to rest a little while longer until the number of their fellow servants and their brothers should be complete, who were killed as they themselves had been. Wow. So calling for vengeance, eh?
I would say yes. One of the guys I read said, no, that's not the idea behind this. But except that asking God to judge, right?
Yeah.
But I agree with you. I think they're calling for vengeance. And these are the saints that have died for their faith.
Okay.
So while they've been slain for the word of God and the witness they had borne. So these are the what we would call the Christian martyrs.
Okay.
And they're crying out in a loud voice, how long, O sovereign Lord, before you're going to judge and avenge our, calling for vengeance, of course, avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth. So once you see all of this warfare, he takes it back to the Christians and the Christians who are being martyred for their faith. And then they're crying out to him, when are you going to do something about this? And remember, we're writing to a suffering church.
Okay.
Remember, we've got martyrs starting to happen in the churches. Ever since the time of Paul, they've been turning Christians over to be killed. The Jewish people are turning Christians over to be killed. And people, the Smyrna church, you're going to spend, you know, 10 days in prison, be faithful to the point of death, and you'll receive the crown of life. And so you've got this happening to the church, to the suffering church. And there's got to be something in their head saying, what is God doing? Like, why is God allowing us to die?
Right.
You know, we read in the Psalms, you know, that swords and death will not come upon us because we're God's children. And now we're dying. So what's going on? And look what happens. Every one of them is given a white robe. So the white robe is the symbol of righteousness here. Here we can do that. We struggled with that white horse earlier, but now we've got the symbol of righteousness. And they're told to wait a little longer. And this is one of the odd places in Scripture for me, is that you've got the dead Christians crying out to God, and God says, wait a little longer until the fellow servants and brothers, the number of them is complete, who are to be killed as you have been killed. And so they're saying, when are you going to judge our blood? And God actually says to them, wait a little while. I got a few more of you that have to die in the way that you died, and then I'll do something about it. Right?
Yeah.
Now, Morris would say, there's not a specific number here. He's just saying it's going to be a little while longer before something happens. But he says it like it's a specific number.
Right. You know?
And if we believe that God knows the end from the beginning, we know that he knows how many this is going to be.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, unless we think that God doesn't know the end from the beginning and we follow along with those guys, you know, we're pretty sure that God is saying to them, you know, I have a plan here.
Yeah.
And part of this plan is that a bunch of you are going to die. Now the opposite of that is going to happen just right away. And he's going to make a point here. But there is a point here in the book of Revelation that all through the book, Christians die.
Right.
Right? And the weird thing is that though all through the book, Christians die, those that don't die, those that are not Christians, are going to wish they were dead, are going to cry out for death. Because there's something bigger happening here than what is happening on the earth.
Okay.
There's something bigger going on. If we're believers, then we believe in eternity, right? We believe that we're going to be with God forever. Some believe in a new Jerusalem, that we're going to live on the earth. Other people have all different ideas of what's going to happen. You know, you're going to live on stars and, you know, maybe some of the other possible planets, you know, that have room, that, you know, M-class planets if you're a Star Trek person. But really what he's saying is there's far more going on than what's happening in our lives.
Mm.
And though we are very strong on life, right? We believe in life from conception to death, to a natural death, they would say, and all those kind of things. God has a bigger plan. And there is a place in Scripture where he says, blessed in the sight of the Lord are the death of his saints.
That's right.
That kind of leads into this one as well.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And basically says, if this is written to a church that's going to die, he's trying to tell us there's more going on than this.
Yeah.
And you can be sad for those that are dead. You can cry for yourself because you're going to be away from them. You can cry for them. But you need to know that God has an unbelievable plan for these people. We don't know what heaven looks like. Some people say they do, and they point to the New Jerusalem and things to talk about heaven. But most of us say, you know, we really don't know what heaven looks like. And we don't know all of the promises for us.
Right?
Like C.S. Lewis said, before the time of internet and TV and all that, kids in inner city of London, you couldn't explain the ocean to them. You couldn't explain a holiday on the ocean because you just don't have the words to say. And it's like that with heaven. We just don't have the words to say how amazing it's going to be.
Yeah. And that's a great analogy, Larry. Great analogy.
Yeah. And that's what's going to happen here. So these are Christians that are going to die. And he says, hey, that's okay too.
Yeah. And it, like you said, it fits through the whole theme of the whole book, right? Christians they're going to suffer. There is going to be death. You know, you'll probably talk to us about the death motif at some point here that goes through the book.
Yeah.
And God is, it's not that he's okay with our suffering. There's no other way to really say it other than that. Because
it's hard to do it, isn't it, Steve? It's hard to work with it. Yeah.
Yeah. But it serves his purpose for his purposes. Okay, cool. Well, then want to read the sixth seal.
Sixth seal.
When he opened the sixth seal, I looked, and behold, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth, and the full moon became like blood, and the stars of the sky fell to the earth as a fig tree sheds its winter fruit when shaken by a gale. The sky vanished like a scroll that is being rolled up, and on every mountain and island, and every mountain and island was removed from its place. Then the kings of the earth and the great ones and the generals and the rich and the powerful and everyone, slave and free, hid themselves in caves and among the rocks of the mountains, calling to the mountains and rocks, fall on us, hide us from the face of him who is seated on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who can stand?
Right. So he finishes the sixth seal, which in a real sense is the last seal. Because remember, the seventh is that pause.
Right.
Silence in heaven for half an hour. And in this one, first I'm going to talk about the kings of the earth, and then I'll come back to the moon like blood.
Okay.
You notice that the sky vanishes, everything's rolled up, and that should be, if that was literal, then that would be the end of everything, and there'd be nothing left, right?
Right.
But here, this happens, and the kings of the earth, and the great, and the generals, and the rich, and the powerful, and the slave, and the free. So everybody on earth that's not a Christian is hiding themselves they're hiding in the caves or hiding in the mountains. They're calling on the rocks to fall on them so that they don't have to face God.
Hmm.
Right? So in verse 9 in the fifth seal, the Christians are dying and they're being martyred for their faith. But in the sixth seal, everybody else is having to face God.
Hmm.
And it's just, it's too terrifying for them.
Right.
And it doesn't matter who you are, you're going to cry for the mountains to just fall on you so you don't have to face God.
Right.
But they are going to have to face God. So there's a very big contrast here between the fifth seal and the sixth seal.
Yeah, like the little joke you and I would say, right? You know, you'll pray for death, but you will not find it, right? You know, this is literally them praying for death, and they must face judgment first before.
That's right. Like in the end of The Italian Job where
yeah.
he says to them, please don't kill me. And they say, oh, we're not going to kill you.
Yeah, we're going to do something far worse.
Yes.
Yeah.
Much worse things are going to happen to you than
death. Yeah. Yeah. And it's really true. Much worse
things. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Now the sixth seal then takes you to the end of time. And the reason I kind of back to that is it actually takes you to what we would want to call the second coming. When they opened the sixth seal, I looked and behold, there was a great earthquake. The sun became black as sackcloth. The moon became like blood. And this seal, this sixth seal, and actually the seven seals is very much like Matthew 13.
Okay.
No, I'm sorry. Mark 13, Matthew 24, and Luke 11. All three of them kind of mention this as well. So do you want to jump over to one of them? Like Mark?
Yeah. 13? Which one? Mark 13?
Mark 13. I was going to say Luke but let's do Mark.
Well, either way, we can go to both too.
Yeah. So you got Jesus talking about the destruction of the temple, right? At the beginning of this, and then the end of the age. And then we get down to verse 14. Because there's quite a bit happening here. And when you see the abomination of desolation standing where it ought not to be, let the reader understand that those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Now, most of us think that this is actually pointing to the first destruction, or the destruction of Jerusalem, not the first, but the second. This is pointing to the destruction of the temple and the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 69-70.
Okay.
And there's actually some evidence that the Christians got out, that when Vespasian was in Jerusalem, he was attacking Jerusalem, and then he left. He had to go back to become, he was the commander, and he went back to become the emperor of Rome. And then the Christians got out, and then a year later he sent Titus back, and Titus sacked Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And that's the sacking of Jerusalem that I believe is mentioned in Josephus, where he talks about they would just surround Jerusalem, not let anybody out, and they would do this waiting game while the people inside starved. Yes.
Hmm.
And Josephus actually talks about people eating their own children and things like that.
Wow.
I used to say, well, you probably wouldn't eat your own children. You'd probably eat your neighbor's children. my brother used to have cows. And at first they would, you didn't want to eat your own cows because you couldn't deal with it mentally. So you would put them into this market, and then they would slaughter them, and everybody would eat it. And he says, you do that for a few years. Then you realize, why am I eating other people's cows when mine are way better than theirs? and you toughen a little.
Yeah. But it's just a horrid thing that they were having to do, right?
Oh, yeah. Unbelievably bad. Unbelievably bad stuff. And whether they actually did that or not, who knows? But Josephus made a little bit of money writing about that stuff. So
Right.
He was a first century historian, Jewish historian.
Right.
Who we think wrote for the Romans.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
So anyway, and then you go down just a little bit, and here's where Matthew and Mark and Luke talk about the same thing in verse 24. He says, but in those days, after that tribulation, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will be falling from heaven, and the powers of heaven will be shaken. And they will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds. So that's remember I said I can be quite symbolic in the book of Revelation, but I'm oddly literal about the second coming.
Right.
Like I feel like the second coming is a very literal event.
Yeah.
And this is where he talks about the Son of Man coming in the clouds with great power and glory to send out his angels to gather the elect from the four winds. And that's where the post-tribulation people say, look, Jesus comes back, then he gathers us. And that's the post-tribulation rapture. So you can see where they get their thing from a little bit, right?
Yeah.
But the other thing that's happening here is this whole idea of the sun darkened and the moon turned to blood. In this one, he doesn't do the blood. He does the moon does not give its light. And so it's the end of time. Stars falling to the earth. We don't know for sure what it is. In Revelation, it could be talking about angels. The fall. Some people say it's the fall of the angels. Remember when the third of the angels fell?
Right.
And Jesus said, I see the Son of Man falling, or the Son of Man, I see Satan falling.
Right.
Better use the right language there.
Yeah.
And then this whole idea of stars falling, some people say it could be just a great meteorite shower.
Right.
Which was what killed the dinosaurs, right?
And
could turn around and kill us as well.
Yeah.
But it's very much the sun darkening, the moon turning to blood is very much pointing to the end times, to the you want to say the end of time, at least to Jesus' return.
Yeah.
So Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21 are all doing something very similar to Revelation chapter 6. And also, right. You and I both read through Joel just a little bit earlier, and Joel does the very same thing as well.
Right.
The abomination of desolation, some say that's the Antichrist. In the book of Daniel, that was the Seleucid king when he stood at the temple in Jerusalem.
Okay.
Standing where he did not belong. And that was actually the beginning of the Maccabean period.
Okay.
With Judas Maccabeus, when the Maccabeans fought back against the Seleucids and actually won a kingdom for Jerusalem for quite a period of time there under the Maccabeans. And some say, well, that's totally God's intervention. And others would say, no, that is the Seleucids were busy with other wars and that's what happened. Well, God can do that too, right?
Exactly.
So look at these pieces of history that kind of form in all of these things. And
right.
then Revelation is picking up on that same language to talk about what's going on.
I get you.
So the very end of that then, Steve, is the very end of the thing in Revelation there says, ooh, nicely done.
Yeah, thank you.
You brought that back very quickly. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who can stand?
Mm.
And then chapter 7 is an answer to that question, who can stand? And we'll do that in the next time we get together.
Yeah. But what an awesome, I mean, you know, it's awesome in a terrifying way. But, you know, this proud people that thought that they could resist and reject God, now no one can stand before him. No one can stand before him and his lamb, right?
Yeah, that's right. No one can stand before him and his lamb. And God is, remember, the Romans, they're afraid of the Romans, they're afraid of the Jews, the Jewish people, and he is saying that God is in control of this whole thing. God is God's the main one in this picture. And that's the one we're going to be with. He is the one we're going to be with. If we could wrap ourselves around this, we would have no fear in our lives.
Yeah.
But we usually don't do that well.
Yeah.
At least I don't.
Guilty. Over here. Guilty. Yeah. Yeah. Are you afraid of things? Oh, no. Not that. Just spiders, snakes, and a few other things. Other than that, I have no fear at all. Right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. We talk brave until it happens.
And we're afraid of being foolish, right? You know, did I use my money wisely in my life, or am I just a fool?
Yeah.
And those are things too.
So true. Larry, this was awesome, bud. It was an awesome look at the not just the four horsemen, but how the seals ties together to this grand vision that God is painting of how he is going to bring justice and how he's going to roll up the fabric of time or the carpet of time, you know, in some ways.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
All right. Well, no, thank you. I got to listen to it, and that was my pleasure actually in this whole thing. Folks, that's it for us this week. We sure are blessed that you join us every week. Again, even if we were just doing this for ourselves, that would be enough, but it's so Larry and I find it just so satisfying to hear that others actually are enjoying this as well. All right, so you can always find us at our website, apocolarry.ca. You'll find our podcasts there. Eventually, we'll put up some other information too when Larry and I aren't busy or lazy. We're not really sure which one we are. And we'll go from there. We should give you some fair warning now as we approach, you know, the Christmas season as we're recording these. We'll probably take, you know, maybe a week or two break. We're still trying to figure that out, how we'll do that. But we will be back in the new year. But that's a few weeks off yet. So you'll have some episodes before Christmas. And then you can give it to your friends as a Christmas present. You know, hey, I bought you something that cost me nothing. How's that sound? You can binge listen to this. You sound like you're all cool, like one of those hipsters on Netflix. I binge listen to the Apocalary podcast. Anyway, thanks so much for joining us. Until next time, Larry and I say goodbye. And thanks so much for joining us.